Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
We're speaking to the awesome Cass Dunn, who is an author, a clinical psychologist, a mindfulness expert, and has a successful podcast called Crappy to Happy. So welcome, Cass. It's great to speak to you. It's great to connect, and we can't wait to get into this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
So we've talked about the song. Do you know the song so that you can actually hum it or anything?
I think it's Sending the Clowns. I think it's from a play, but it's like...
Thank it's a happy, you, sad thank thing. Thank you.
So there they've you just go. Told us that it's from a musical called A Little... What? A Little Light Music. There you
right,
go.
Right.
There we go. There we
but
go.
Clowns do scare me. That's the only thing. Clowns do scare me. You know the way people have been tying teddy bears to poles and stuff outside their houses?
Oh, going on a bear hunt.
Yeah. Somebody tied a clown to one of the houses near Air Place, and I live in the hills, and every time the kids go past, I'm like, oh, Dad, there's that clown. Like, I just look at this clown coming over.
Some people are quite clown phobic. Yeah, some people don't.
I'm a bit clown phobic.
Yeah.
So, Cass, we might just get stuck into maybe asking you a couple of questions about how you got into this whole concept of from crappy to happy. Where did that come from?
Oh, good question. So I obviously I've been working as a psychologist. Prior to that, I was a coach. I have done, had my own whole long journey in terms of my own personal and professional development in the fields of psychology and personal development, mindfulness, meditation. And interestingly, it was about 5 years ago when I first moved my family. We moved to the Sunshine Coast hinterland from the city. We made that tree sea change. I was still commuting to the city to maintain a private practice, psychology practice at the time. But I was very interested in moving my work more online and, reaching a wider number of people, also being able to work from home as much as I could. Anyway, so long story short, if you run an online business, there's this whole thing where you have to build an email list and you have to put out something, a freebie. We all know this, right? You have to put out the lead magnet to get the people to get on your email list. And I was racking my brains about what I could call this this thing, because I wanted to give somebody this little challenge in more of like a positive psychology, like a boost your mood kind of thing. And I just was sitting on my back deck one day and crappy to happy just popped into my mind. And at the time, everybody was sort of from surviving to thriving, or from frazzled to fabulous. People were coming up with all of these little, arcs. And yeah. I just thought, no, you know what, really? It's just crappy to happy. Like, that's what that says it all. Mm. So crappy to happy came about as a 5-day or 7-day email challenge, which still exists. You can still opt in for that on my website. And then a few years later, fast forward, when I was my friend Tiff Hall, obviously who's a fitness trainer, and I were approached to put together a podcast, and thinking of a name, somebody said, oh, what about Crappy to Happy? Because they'd seen it on my website. And so then it became a podcast, and then it became a series of books, and right. Now I have my own online program. So it's become a little bit of a brand in and of itself. Beautiful. The whole Crappy to Happy thing.
Good work.
Perfect.
Good work.
So can you just tell me what we have our own kind of definition of what happy is, or what people are aspiring to in terms of getting to that happy place. Can you tell me what you consider to be happy?
Yes. So, there's obviously happiness is a very fleeting emotion for most people. We feel happy when we get the new job or lose weight or buy the new house or whatever it is. And the definition of happiness that I'm talking to is deeper and more lasting than that. I use the word happy because everybody gets it. Everybody, it's all what everybody wants in life. And any goals we are pursuing, as you guys would know, I'm sure, like at the end of the day, it's not about the goal. It's what do you think that's going to make you? How what do you think that's going to give you? Yeah. Well, I'd be so happy. Like I'd feel something. It's an emotional thing. But for me, happiness is really about living your life in a way that is in aligned with your values, that is has some sense of purpose and meaning. It's the things that really investing your energy into the things that really support your optimal well-being, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Mm. So it's not actually chasing those quick hits of dopamine, the quick success, the quick wins or whatever, which really at the end of the day leave you feeling very flat and can actually keep you just continually just chasing and never arriving where you think this magical happiness land mm-hmm. is going to be. So it's really, and to me, that's what I try to do, is to educate people about that fundamental difference and ask, where are you putting your energy and is it into the things that are going to give you that lasting kind of fulfillment?
Mm. It's funny because it's like, you know, happy. I think over the past 10 or 15 years, the word happiness kind of wore out, you know, this whole punch the air, you know, burn your feet on hot coals, high-fiving each other. It seemed to be, you know, transient, lucid. It didn't hold any space and time for people for real. It was very tiresome. And, there's a great Dee Martini quote where he says, I gave up happiness because it was making me feel too sad. Because
it's a true thing.
Yeah, it's very true. And so it's lovely and refreshing to see someone, especially a psychologist, pushing it back into more of a balanced state and view. But I think that, you know, people are very open to that now. You know, people want to hear the reality of what happiness actually is.
And I think that the labeling of it, like as in from crappy to happy, people probably come to you for the whole concept of this quick fix or this how do I just be happy? But then we go into something deeper, which is really refreshing for us. That's definitely what we talk about. It's like that there's that happiness is transient, it is momentary, but there is a state when you can live in alignment with your values and when you can live in alignment with the truth and the essence of who you are that gives you a sense of that well-being and happiness and connectedness as such, as an overall.
Because I think in that place, it attracts an equal, you know, happiness is, from the way I see it, is being able to know that when you're in your values, you're able to handle the challenge and handle the support, you know, handle the praise and handle the reprimand, that's what happiness is. How do you see that?
Yeah, I agree. And I was just going to say too, I mean, a lot of my work obviously as a psychologist and this is my focus on a lot of the mindfulness is about being able to turn towards things that are actually uncomfortable in life and not to, because happiness will often, people will, in their attempts to be happy, people will obviously will often tend to seek to escape or avoid or run away from the things that make them feel uncomfortable, when often what they really want, the thing that's going to make their life more fulfilling, is on the other side of that discomfort. It's actually turning into that, turning towards that. Hmm. And I believe that real happiness, to use that word, is that knowing, that deep knowing that I actually have the resilience I can deal with this. Like I can sit with something that's uncomfortable, and that's why I teach people mindfulness. Like I can sit with that something that's uncomfortable because it matters to me. Like it's in the service of something that is really, truly important to me. So I'm not spending my life pressing the eject button to opt out of whatever stress or discomfort or difficult conversations or whatever it might be, you know, risk, uncertainty. I can actually know what matters, and I'm prepared to tolerate a little bit of the dissatisfaction to get there.
How do you talk to people about turning inwards then to that discomfort in order to get to that point? What do you talk to them about?
Well, a lot about just raising that awareness of what does a fulfilling and meaningful life look like and feel like. And I guess because I teach mindfulness meditation, and there are meditation processes which are really just things that we can put into place that give people some structure or some process really, just to be able to observe what I'm experiencing, noticing. It all starts with noticing and noticing what are the old habits and patterns that I tend to fall into, and where do I tend to seek to avoid, or what do I move away from? And then can I just observe with that detached sort of perspective? That's what mindfulness is, right? So what is the story that I'm telling myself? What's coming up for me in my emotions? Like what's happening out there, and what's that triggering in me? And can I just bring some curiosity to that, and can I just stay with that for a minute just to explore it, as opposed to doing the immediate like run, don't, you know, avoid. So it's just I guess it's a mindfulness practice, and it's the willingness to just be curious. But I would say with that, with mindfulness, when I say to people, like, turn towards what's uncomfortable, I mean, that can be feel excruciating for people, but it's always with compassion. And so this is, it has to be with kindness and compassion for ourselves, which is something that humans are terrible at. Like, yes, we are so self-critical, so self-judgmental. And so I just don't think that you can teach people to, you know, get in close with what feels really, really hard, unless you also, you know, help them to learn that self-kindness.
I think, I don't know about you, but I think that one of the things that, you know, sometimes people are afraid to lean into that stuff because they just feel that leaning into, you know, the pain of anything is just going to bring more pain. But I've just found that over the years when, with the right guidance, when people lean into stuff, they can, and then they get to the other side, you know, the conscious mind goes, yeah, I get on the other side of, you know, of fear is courage, and yeah, I get on the other side of fear is strength, and I get all that. But when there's you know, an actual a click, you know, there's a breakthrough, there's an epiphany of some sort, what tends to happen is that people do have this moment of and realizing, oh my God, you know, so that happened, and out of that happening I became this, and I've needed all these things because my kids needed them or my husband needed them. And so I think we're at a point now where we're able to talk about what it is to lean into something that happened to you, because, you know, we go from that, you know, that word conversation of, hey, you know, on the other side of this are all these great things, but in actual fact there really is, you know, there is a moment that I think I've just found awaits every human being when they're willing to lean in enough, and that moment is truly, truly profound. Have you found that?
Yeah. And I mean, not on a big aha, big explosive kind of scale, but yes, on those little moments where people really, a penny just drops, and they make that. It's really moving, isn't it? Like, it's moving from getting something intellectually to actually really experiencing that emotionally, or, yeah, you know, embodying that in some way, and really realizing that is as a truth for yourself, and you have to experience it really.
Yeah.
You know, any emotion, no matter how intense, we know this, like, any emotion, no matter how intense, if you are able to stay with it, they peak and they pass in a relatively short period of time. Yeah. But most of the time we're so busy trying to run away and avoid those things, like run away from those things, that we never give ourselves that opportunity to really, really get to the other side.
So you were saying about your values and, you know, in alignment with who you are. Can you talk to me about how you would help people, or how you see the values or people's, you know, what they love, et cetera. How does that help them to connect with this happy state that you talk about?
That's such an interesting question, because I actually find that a lot of people, and I've been running retreats as well recently, I've run a couple of them, and we have these conversations about values, and people really tend to struggle with knowing what their values are. And so it takes a bit of, I don't know if you guys experience that as well, but it can take a bit of exploring and digging to really get people to. That could end up being a really complex kind of a question, because I think there is so much of what we think matters to us, or what we think we should pursue or want or whatever, because it's all been conditioned.
A lot of the time it seems like, you know, when we're dealing with people with values, when they work out what their values are, the first time they're my values, it's like, no, they're actually not your values. You know, a lot of time they go, oh, I actually don't value this stuff at all. In fact, they're my mum's values, or they're my husband's values, or they're, you know, so people in first looking at the concept of you know, the study of axiology or the study of value systems, when they look at that for the first time, one of the big realizations is, hold on a minute, I'm not living what I love. I'm living what someone else wants me to love, or I'm doing this because I'm getting approval because I'm doing it.
Exactly. But that's why I always say to people, like, it's not just sit down and say, oh, here's my top five values or two values or whatever they are. Like, there's a process there. There's a lot of exploration that has to go. You have to sit and let that percolate for a little while. And really, and again, just always with the idea of, like, coming back to what feels really true for me. And there's a lot of, sometimes there's a lot of excavating that has to go on before you can actually get there. So it's not, again, it's not just a, oh, here they are, here's my neat top five values and I'm going to stick them on the fridge. And
Why do you think it's so important, though? Why do you think it's so important to know that whole values and what you're grounded in terms of getting to that place, in terms of that happy?
Because I think that that is the only way to really live a life that is going to be meaningful or have any sense of real purpose.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's all kind of superficial, isn't it? It's all just a little, it's all sort of just skimming the surface.
So then, it's saying then that that superficial is never going to get the happy. That you've got to go deep, you've got to understand, you've got to have that sense of meaning in order to get to that point of happy. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm sure there are people who are, there's possibly people listening going, I don't know, look, I'm pretty happy. And on a day-to-day basis, we some people, you know, obviously we are. Mm. We're pretty content with life. But there's a whole lot of other people who have this, like, oh, Jesus, like, I'm sure, surely there's more to it than this. Like, it's you know, it's that sort of yearning for to connect with something deeper. And I sometimes think that often happens after you've sort of ticked all the boxes that you're supposed to tick. I finished school and I did that degree and I got that job and I got married and bought the house and I settled down and, like, is that it?
But I think that is, you know, I think that's, like, I don't think anybody gets to skip that. I think that's innately built into every single human being.
What, that we think that we've got to hit some sort of milestone?
We think that there's something outside of us. There's always, you know, without the fantasy of ecstasy, we would consider life shiz. But there seems to be this thing outside of us. And I think it's a healthy thing. I think people should be inquisitive. They should want to look. We should want to learn more. We shouldn't just settle. I think that we should think about how we're thinking. And because, you know, I think mindfulness is kind of a part of the revolution of thinking that I think is going on at the moment anyway.
Can you tell us your perspective on mindfulness then, Cass? What role do you think it plays?
You mean currently?
Yeah. Well, just in general, in terms of living that, in terms of living a life that is happy instead of crappy.
Well, okay, so obviously my professional training is as a psychologist and I've spent a lot of time in rooms with and a coach, and I've spent a lot of times, years, sitting with people with the intention of helping them to feel better. So these are people who from at all ends of the spectrum, people who are living a relatively good, you know, life and achieving goals but just want something more, and also people who are really, you know, depressed, anxious, really struggling, really experiencing sometimes some really serious, you know, mental health issues and unwanted intrusive thoughts. And so for me as a psychologist, there was a wave, and anybody who knows the history of psychology knows this, like, there was a wave of, you just challenge those thoughts. You just tell yourself not to think those thoughts. And that's CBT. That's what CBT is. And, you know, obviously there's a behavioral part, like what you can do, but a lot of it was about looking at what you're thinking and then somehow disputing or challenging or looking for the evidence that those thoughts aren't true. And in my experience personally, in my own life, and in my experience in treating or helping other people, I always found that to be largely ineffective.
Yeah. The psychology board would want to murder you right now, probably, for saying that.
There's a lot of people in the psychology profession who would agree with me. It's limited. Oh, like, for some people, if there is something that you can clearly, like, I will always still present that to people. If you can identify that this is what I'm telling myself, and you know, like, sometimes that just noticing it in itself is enough to go, oh, well, that's clearly rubbish. Yeah. You know, like, you can have that, you can just dismiss that. But oftentimes people end up in just getting more trapped in their own, in this inner dialogue, and then arguing with themselves and just running around and around in circles in their own mind. And I find it, and just feeling worse, not to mention the fact that there is, you know, there was one kind of major study where, you know, if you tell somebody not to think something, just don't think about white pandas for the next 5 minutes, anything else but white pandas, don't think about white pandas. You cannot not think about, the research would clearly indicate that you're not only going to think about white pandas more in the next 5 minutes than you otherwise would, but you'll continue to have random thoughts of white pandas pop into your head. Thought suppression does not work. Mm. So for me, it just makes more sense intuitively, and the evidence would show as well that if I can just learn to observe those thoughts and not get so hung up on them, like not get so caught up, like not have to believe everything I think, not have to act on every impulse that I have, not have to get into a debate with myself in my own head. If I can just learn to just see that thought as a passing mental event, I can't always stop it. We all have random shit pop in our heads all day long, don't we? Like, I don't have to attach myself so much to those thoughts. And that goes for how I see myself, thoughts about me, my identity, all sorts of stuff. For me, it is just that ability to step back and observe, and not just my thoughts, but then also like what's happening in my body, because this whole obsession we have with our thinking mind and intellectualizing everything and analyzing every problem and rationalizing every emotion, that stuff keeps us completely disconnected from the neck down and all of the wisdom that's available in our body and our intuition. And so I just think there is so much value in not putting so much weight or giving so much power, I suppose, to this, like this, the neck, from the neck up, all of this stuff that's between our ears. Yeah. I mean, it can be our most powerful resource, but oh boy, like it can also be like just your worst enemy. Mm. So I just think at every level, the ability to just observe and feel and have the willingness to do that, and then to make more conscious choices rather than reacting.
Yeah.
Reacting rather, to be able to choose a response, to go back to our conversation about what is in line with my values. Like, who do I want to be in this moment?
Yeah.
Do I want to behave this way? Do I want to react this way? Or do I want to choose something that's a little bit more considered?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's in my relationships, whether it's in my career, or whether it's in whatever thing I'm dealing with, then I think that's it's a far more helpful approach.
What do you consider are people's main, like, blocks, I suppose, to achieving this level of happy that you talk about, Cass? You know, I mean, I'm going to let you answer the question. I know that for me, there's lots of types of behavior that would stop people from feeling those things. You know, like people trying to please other people, for example, or people, you know, not understanding their values at a particular level, or not having boundaries and stuff like that. You know, what do you consider as some of the biggest blocks to people's personal levels of happiness?
I think you probably just touched on a few of them, you know, but which they all stem from the same, have the same root cause. But, you know, that idea about I mean, this is Brené Brown's kind of field as well. You know, what does she say? That perfectionism, people pleasing, pretending, like these are all kind of strategies designed to, again, to avoid feeling discomfort, to avoid the risk of somehow disappointing another person and therefore betraying ourselves for the sake of, you know, pleasing somebody else, or to fend off a fear of, you know, rejection or criticism. And again, with compassion, we are social creatures. From an evolutionary, you know, biology perspective, if we were ostracized by the tribe, we were left for dead. So we have an innate need for that acceptance and that belonging and that community. I think it's just, again, with that self-awareness, being able to observe, well, how are my attempts to fit in and to be accepted and to belong, actually, how am I it's betraying myself almost. But, you know, self-doubt, self-criticism, fear, they're the blocks. Not trusting myself, not backing myself, putting other people's wants, needs, preferences, opinions ahead of my own, because I think that's what I need to do to gain approval and validation, as opposed to, again, just coming back and being true to what's going to really make me feel satisfied.
So I suppose listening to that, Cass, you know, we have this conscious mind where we want things to be different and we want things to be, you know, better for us and everybody, you know, we want to, and then when we're not there in our physical world at that, we haven't turned up there yet, because the outer world is not matching what we're wanting to feel in our conscious mind. That's where we start to pretend, and people start to, you know, pretend that they're happy or pretend that they're wealthy or pretend that they're rich or pretend that they're content. Mm-hmm. And then that seems to just become a way of life. You know, it's like an injury. You just adapt to that way of life. But when we're talking about, mm-hmm. Where that stuff comes from, you know, not feeling enough, you know, we're talking about at a subconscious level, right? Because the subconscious mm-hmm. processor has way, way, way more control than the conscious processor. So how do you, with your people, deal with that subconscious stuff? Or do you deal with that with them?
Yeah. And again, that's a process, because yeah. you can't see what you can't see. Like, we all have yeah. blind spots, which by definition we yeah. can't see. Yeah, look, I think, again, a lot of that stuff is running underneath the surface. And sometimes I will just get people to I often will explain to people where those kind of core beliefs come from. Like, I talk yeah. about early experiences. Like, yeah. you know, we all have these early experiences, and depending on how you're parented or the messages that you receive or what happens in life, like, you might form, even before you have words to describe what you're thinking, you will imprint some of this information, and it will form your sense of identity. And I think sometimes just explaining that and having people to reflect on some of those early experiences and what might they have made of that, not at a conscious level, but what might they have kind of taken on from those experiences in terms of their beliefs about themselves, about other people, about the world, about how the world works, about how relationships work, about what do I need to do to get my approval or my sense of, you know, validation. Yeah. And so that's sometimes that helps, you know, to working with a coach or working with a psychologist. Sometimes that can be really helpful to have somebody else with a different perspective to help to uncover that. But a lot of times people can do some of that stuff themselves as well. And then just start to identify, oh crap, like, I've all of these decisions that I've made, or all of these ways that I have, you know, limited myself or held myself back from things because I just thought this.
Yeah.
But I think also there is something there about, and this is the other side of the mindfulness. It's about tapping into your body. And I haven't done loads of research or practice in this area myself, but I've attended a little bit of professional development training. And it's all about this idea that the body holds your wisdom, your body holds, the body keeps the score. There's, you know, Bessel van der Kolk, Babette Rothschild. There's a lot of trauma therapists particularly. So I guess people particularly who've had injuries, emotional, psychological kind of injuries in childhood with difficult parenting or whatever, you know, that some of this stuff gets stored at a cellular level. So there's a lot of body stuff that you can do to move those things through you as well. And again, I'm not the expert, but I think just learning to listen to your body and trust your body and just trust your gut, literally, because there is so much there to be learned that is, it, you know, we've all walked out of the house and thought, crap, I've forgotten something. Like, we have no idea what it is. Mm-hmm. And we all have that experience, but you know, there is something in you that knows that you've left something at home and then you'll get to where you're going and then you'll remember what it is. It's like your body knows.
Yeah.
And we tend to dismiss and deny, you know, or just ignore some of that stuff as well. So I think it's a whole holistic thing, really, isn't it?
Can we talk a little bit about the boundaries then, and about, because I'd really like to touch on that, and I also like to touch on perfectionism and how that kind of impedes in our levels of happiness as well, because I feel like so many people, you know, forget that setting some hard lines is actually, like Brené Brown talks about, I know you mentioned Brené already, but she talks about it that, you know, in her research that some of the most compassionate people actually have the strictest boundaries, you know. And I think that would also translate to people that are happier also would have the strictest boundaries, and not because of the fact that they're, you know, people don't want to own sometimes the things that they have to do that are maybe a little bit more difficult, but they don't, I don't think people understand that the importance of doing that for yourself is paramount. So I don't know, could you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, and I've probably got an example of that too. Like so Brené Brown's position on that, which I agree, it's very, you know, it's absolutely true, is that the compassion, the most generous people are the ones with the strictest boundaries, because you can't genuinely be generous if you are feeling resentful, if you're feeling put upon and imposed upon. And so if you're in that people pleasing, always saying yes, or, you know, going the extra mile or helping people out, and a lot of people see that as being very, like, noble, like it's very generous. There's a lot of people who think that's a really good thing, and have, again, maybe have been raised to believe that. But over time, typically that leads to this underlying, like this sort of rumbling, like underlying kind of resentment and feeling annoyed, and then people get a bit passive aggressive, or people get, you know, cranky or irritable or whatever they do, or however that plays out. But I know myself, because I work online and I have people, I have worked in other people's programs as the psychologist and all of the rest of it. And the online world is 24/7, you know, like there's always something on social media. There's always somebody. And I remember one day I think it was a weekend. I was really tired. I'd been working hard and I was sitting down having a coffee on a Saturday morning and picked up my phone. This was a few years ago. And for whatever reason, I don't think it was a Facebook message. I think it was actually an email, but it was this long email asking me, that had come via another source, and it was basically saying, oh, hey, Cass, one for you, or one for you to help us out with, or something. And this was somebody who clearly needed immediate and urgent psychiatric. Like, this was a person, I don't remember what the exact details were. It wasn't suicidal, but it was something like really significant. Now, we're talking about me doing online, yeah, you know, Facebook lives, psychoeducation, general information, not therapy, yeah, not clinical treatment, yeah, and absolutely not on the freaking Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, yeah, when I'm having a coffee.
Yeah.
So it was just so, I just felt so imposed upon, and I could not access any part of it. This person needed help, and I couldn't access any sort of compassion or generosity. I just felt really pissed off. Because yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm a human being, right? Yeah. And I, you know, to a lesser extent, just people who message or send me Facebook messages. And again, I can have compassion for those people, and I can redirect them to where they need to go, as if I've got boundaries in place. But otherwise, if I just feel like I am everybody's 24/7 yeah, go-to psychologist for every little thing, I just can't do that. I can't be generous, and I can't be kind. Yeah. So I totally get that, and I totally get that importance. If I want to do good work, and if I want to be my best self and give my best, not just to my family but to all of the other people who look to me for support or whatever, then I have to draw those lines, yeah, and maintain those boundaries. And I think it's a lesson that we learn from experience as well.
Yeah, it's difficult as well, because, I mean, you want, you know, I'm you know, we want to help. You know, we want to help,
yes,
and we genuinely want to help. But it does kind of feel like, no, you know, you're taking the piss. You can't. That's yes, okay.
Well,
you know, you can't message me on a Sunday morning, and you know.
That's, well, I kind of made that rule, because I remember years ago I used to give out my phone number, and every now and then I'd get phone. You know, Sunday morning, because I'm in Perth.
I had someone a big fight with my boyfriend last night. Can you please ring?
Yeah,
him?
And it was just like, and it was just consistent. And now I just don't even have Messenger on my phone, because I know that people will just come to me through Messenger in order to, you know, and I have to have certain sort of boundaries. But it feels, I know that for some people it feels kind of difficult to do that, or that feels contra-intuitive, you know, almost, because you're feeling like, you know, I have to be really tough on this, but it's actually going to cause me to be, you know, feel better about myself, but I have to be really tough, you know. So the people, I think, feel like that you know, those parts of themselves that they don't necessarily want to own, that sense of I don't know, what do you call it, you know, when they're really direct, you know, or they're really
it's that part's called the killer.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean? I don't mean it like that. I mean it like they feel like these attributes that they have, like being direct and being forceful or being firm, for example, are going to hurt other people. Yeah. And so,
but you got to look, like I look at it with my kids, you know, like I don't draw a line with the kids because I'm trying to beat up on them or because I'm trying to give them a hard time. I draw a line because I love them. You know, if you understand that, you draw lines because, you know, ultimately, you know, I love me, I love them. And if I don't have that line, then I'm not going to feel okay and they're not going to feel okay. So you draw lines for, I think because, well, you have boundaries because you genuinely do care, you know. But it does get blurred. Saturday morning, text message, it does get blurred.
Yeah, and look, I didn't have to check my email on the Saturday morning. Yeah. I could have, and I now I'm much better at that. Like that's a thing, because people can email whenever they like, of course, but it's up to me when I choose to check those emails. Yeah. And also I went back with some, you know, some guidelines about what's appropriate for me and what's general advice or direction. Where can I point somebody versus where, at what point do you say you need to go and see your GP right now? Like you need to make it, you know, get some professional help now. This is not a Facebook Live.
Can you talk about perfectionism as well then, and how that impedes our mission to, you know, be happy?
Yeah. And look, again, this is one where I think there's, again, perfectionism. A lot of people really wear that badge and really pride themselves on perfectionism. And I think that a lot of people don't, or maybe they have a sense, but they don't really understand that there is a distinct difference between a healthy striving for achievement, a healthy striving to do a good job and to do good work, which we all, you know, hopefully have that. And what is really unhealthy clinical perfectionism, which is this constant almost fear or overriding belief that nothing that I ever do will ever be quite good enough. And it is very much fear-based, I think, and it just keeps us stuck and small. It prevents people, women, I'm going to say women especially, but it prevents women from moving forward or making progress. Or, and I'm a recovering perfectionist. I own that. I remember the first time when I created that little 7-day crappy to happy email thing, and I set up my Facebook ads and I set it, it's all ready to go, and I was ready to push that out into the world. And I sat there literally looking at that button terrified for 30 minutes. It was about midnight. I finally had it finished and I was like, what if nobody likes it? What if it's not good enough? Maybe I should go back and check it again. What, you know, like maybe I just need to run through it one more time. Maybe I should just tweak this. And I would go back to blog posts and I would reread a blog post and put in a different comma or switch around a sentence. It's like, what are you doing? It's like, nobody cares. Yeah. It's just this constant feeling like you need to be doing a little bit more before it will be good enough. And it's very progress inhibiting, and it's very mentally taxing.
Yeah.
Based on go on, carry on.
Yeah, no, I just think that the more that we can actually, and again, it takes practice, it takes leaning into that discomfort. Mm. And if we want to go back to what we were talking about right at the beginning, like being okay to put out something that might not be perfect because my values say that I think this could be helpful to somebody, and I think that, and that's what I want to do. I'm not about me being perfect. I'm about somebody else having some access to something that might be of use or of benefit to them, even if it's got some freaking typos in it, or even if it's not the most, you know, whatever.
We had to read through some of your blog posts, and we were going to talk to you about some of your typos today, just to get that off our chest. Can I just say something about leaning in? Because I think it's important for us to actually clear it up, that when people hear, okay, I've got to lean into the pain of something, they think it's going to be for hours, and they think it's, but we got to remember, it's like I see it with my kids, you know, if they fall over and they hurt themselves, you know, within like 2 or 3 minutes, they're back up. And once you let them feel it, just feel it, you know, it's over in minutes. You know, it's like one of the I think it's important for us to and for people to know that when you're leaning into something, it's not forever. You know, it doesn't mean, oh, I have to lean into this pain, I have to lean into this sense of loss forever. No, it's fleeting. It's momentary. It's just like, it's, you know, it's just a, like that elusive happiness. You know, it's fleeting. It's momentary. But when we're in that true state of gratitude and happiness, we're able to handle both sides. And we see that we can lean into it and it doesn't last that long. And we are just little kids on the inside that have turned up in these big bodies. And I just think it's important for people to understand that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And, you know, it, oftentimes, like with anything in life, the anticipation is more painful. The anticipation of what is going to hurt you is way worse than the actual thing.
Yeah.
So after half an hour pressing the submit button, I closed my computer and went to bed and, oh, what do you know? Like, it was all fine.
Yeah.
It's the stories we create in our own mind about what will people think? What will people think? What if it's not good enough?
So this is a point then, because we're going to have to wrap it up shortly, Casper. I think what the message I'm getting as you've been speaking is that basically, you know, we've got this sort of drive to get to this point of happy, and what makes us to get there is that alignment with the truth of who we are and the essence of who we are and what we love. But I think that what hinders us is the way that we perceive other people see us. Because that perfectionism, the boundaries, the people-pleasing, the self-doubt, the fear, all of that is rooted in how we perceive we're seen by other people. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and it's not even – and that's a great point, Mills, because the people-pleasing – and this is how I sometimes spin that for people who are people pleasers, is have they ever considered that it's really a kind of a form of manipulation? And it's not that generous, really, because what you're doing is you're not doing what you want to do or being honest about what's true for you, but you are behaving in a way that you think somebody else wants you to, so that they will like you. And it's not even you're behaving in a way that somebody else wants you to. You're behaving in a way that you have decided you think they want you to behave so that you'll get them to like you. Mm. So, yes, just on that. So, yes, it's this concern all the time about how we perceive that we might be judged. Mm. And I just want to say that too, just also about this pursuit of happiness or this pursuit of whatever meaning, or, you know, humans are designed to strive towards meaningful goals. We're designed to thrive and to grow and to develop and all of that. So it's not that chasing goals or wanting to achieve is a bad thing. I would never say that. But I think that it's about knowing that the goals are the really important ones, not the, and we know there's loads of research about which goals ultimately will make you happy and which ones will make you miserable, like which ones won't. And fame, wealth, power don't make you happy in any sustainable way. But also the life satisfaction, the personal satisfaction, the joy of goal pursuit is in the pursuit. Mm. It's not even in the achievement.
Absolutely.
It's in the process.
Mm. Yeah.
And so we've got to be, it's that act. And in fact, many people, you know, work really hard towards a really big goal and then they get to the goal. You've probably experienced this too, or you've seen it. And then they're deflated, completely deflated.
Yeah.
And they weren't even appreciating the journey because they were just so focused on when I get there.
So the destination is the journey.
Well, it's that old cliche, but it's so true. And so I think there's a lot of joy and a lot of happiness to be found in that process and in those moments and on a daily basis. Instead, we have this tendency to just always put it out in front of us. Like, oh, it's always around the corner. It's always on the other side of the goal or the problem or the whatever.
Beautiful.
Okay, so anyone who wants to get a copy of the book, I know nobody can see that, but I'm holding up the book, From Crappy to Happy.
There are two.
And there's another book,
So the second one is Crappy to Happy, Love What You Do, which is about finding more meaning in your work. And the one that I'm writing right now, due to the publisher pretty soon, is the Crappy to Happy Relationships.
Beautiful.
So about how to have more feeling relationships.
And how else can people find you, Cass?
I'm on CassDunn.com, pretty simple. I'm on Facebook, Cassandra Dunn Psychologist, which is quite a mouthful, but I'm not going to change my Facebook ID because all the other people won't be able to find me anyway. And Cass_XO on Instagram and all of the rest of it, but it's all on my website.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time. We've loved having a chat.
It was great hanging out. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks so much.
Take care. God bless.
If you found this information inspiring, make sure you subscribe and tune in to the next Dorothy and the Dealer podcast.